The writer David Goldblatt now examines the long and unexpected journey towards its domination of the game.
The 2022 FIFA World Cup is Qatar.
That is astonishing. Expect amazing is their slogan, and a lot of people in the room will be amazed.
The FIFA World Cup has become the greatest show on earth, a celebration of the universal virtues of play. Its gigantic television audiences are the closest that we come to humanity as an imagined community. Like all international sports federations, FIFA, the global governing body of world football, holds the game in trust for the rest of us and claims to serve our universal interests. And just for a moment, awarding the World Cup to Qatar appeared inspired. The Arab world's first sporting mega event, and combined with Russia's successful bid for the 2018 World Cup, a recognition of the new global geography of power. In the last half century, FIFA and the world of football have been transformed by the globalization of television and economic and political power. To understand the origins of FIFA's current malaise, we start in Paris in 1904, where representatives of seven European football associations founded the organisation. The British, although implored to join, stood aloof and distant, suspicious of foreign involvement. And as Professor Paul Dicci, France's leading football historian, explains, of their wider social mission.
There are a lot of organization which aimed to create internationalism in many fields: art, sciences, culture. The creation of IOC 10 years before the creation of FIFA was part of this movement. So the first intention was to insert football in this movement of internationalism, organize, develop international football.
Absent at the moment of creation, the British did join FIFA, only to leave the organisation twice after the First World War, and remained outside the FIFA fold until after the Second. Unperturbed, FIFA continued to grow, adding new members on every continent.
The creation of World Cup in 1930 is a result of a huge conflict between FIFA and IOC. Born with the success of the football tournament, one of the most popular events of the Olympic Games, and a major source of income. But in the same time, the footballers were not real amateurs. After the Olympic Games of Paris 1924, the IOC decided to apply a very restrictive definition of amateurism. FIFA officials were convicted that they need to organize their own competition, a competition open to the professional, and a world competition.
The British press barely reported the 1930 World Cup, but the rest of the world took note. In 1934, Mussolini's Italy staged the Second World Cup and applied the arts of political stage management and global PR to the occasion. France 1938 was no less political, a demonstration that a democracy could stage a mega event as well as any fascist dictatorship. As Professor Paul Darby, author of Africa, Football and FIFA, argues, the new players meant the rules of the game were going to change as well.
European football nations had treated FIFA as a private club in terms of access to high-profile administrative places, hosting rights for the World Cup in terms of opportunities to participate in the World Cup. African nations, when they acquired their independence, of course, what they wanted to do was to assert themselves on the world stage. So within the space of maybe 5 to 10 years, there was a considerable African constituency within the context of FIFA. And of course, this generated huge problems for the world organization.
And the conflict exploded at the occasion of the English World Cup in 1966. Only one place at the final competition was reserved to Africa, Asia and Oceania. The major part of the African Federation decided to boycott the preliminary competition to the World Cup. Thanks to that, they obtained for the next World Cup one place reserved to Africa. But they wanted more.
For the African nations, progress was far too slow. And of course, waiting in the wings at this time was João Havelange.
João Havelange was a supreme networker who had woven together a tapestry of sporting, political and industrial contacts that had made him a millionaire businessman, a member of the IOC and since 1970 the president of the Brazilian Football Association. His challenge to Rouse arose from a mixture of vaulting ambition and simmering discontent in world football with the dominance of Europe. He was multilingual, charismatic and ruthless. Guido Tognoni, a former media director at FIFA and a close aide to both Havelange and Blatter, saw the new president at close quarters.
Havelange was maybe the biggest personality FIFA ever had. He was a very, very strong man, physically strong, and his physical presence was really impressive. You know, he was tall, he was like a man made out of steel, you know. When he looked at your eyes strongly, then you did not know what was coming, you know. He knew exactly how to make use of his power.
The problem that he had when he came to power was that FIFA was not the multi-billion dollar industry that it is today. The World Cup was barely breaking even. Probably the first relationship that he established was the most significant, and that was a relationship with Horst Dassler, of course, the head of Adidas.
Dassler had almost everything. FIFA's ear, global connections, marketing brilliance. But he needed someone who could persuade the world's biggest companies to back football. That man was the marketing expert, Patrick Nally.
Horst asked me if I would join him to see if I can help make the plan of Havelange work. And one of the companies that I was working with was the Coca-Cola company. And I spent a long time looking at how football being the universal sport, Coca-Cola being the universal drink, could actually, with the universal language, work closely together.
Was there a sense at Coca-Cola that football, if not quite a Trojan horse, was certainly a way of getting to the parts they otherwise couldn't reach?
The whole basis of our initial discussion was very much on that brief. FIFA gave them the ability to go around the world.
So Coca-Cola effectively provided the finances that allowed Havelange to fulfil his promises to the African continent. If he wanted to continue to be the figurehead of FIFA, he would have to go down this route of commercialisation.
When Spain bid for the World Cup, it was based on the format of 16 teams. So for FIFA to actually live up to Havelange's requirements to add more teams from Africa and Asia, we had to take the World Cup from 16 teams to 24 teams.
Guido Tognoni.
FIFA came from nowhere financially. You know, I know that in 82 they really had nearly more or less empty cash boxes. In 78 it was even worse. In 86 it was a contract which had a value of 49 million Swiss francs for the world television rights, which is peanuts today, but it was a big money on in those days. So it was a restless extension of the power and of the influence of FIFA. We were creating new tournaments, you know, under 17, under 20, under 23 for the Olympics, the Women's World Cup under 20, and so on and so forth.
In 1998, Havelange bowed out at the top of his game. In his 24 years of autocratic rule, FIFA had become a much slicker and wealthier operation. The global boom in football's importance and wealth that began under Havelange reached new heights under Sepp Blatter.